Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
The Wives of Los Alamos tells the story of the making of the atomic bomb from the perspective of the scientists' wives, who did not know what their husbands were building. It's a novel that sheds light onto one of the strangest and most monumental research projects in modern history, and a testament to a remarkable group of women who carved out a life for themselves in spite of the chaos of war and the shroud of intense secrecy. And I will add, really gray buildings, because we almost moved there when I was a kid, and we took a tour, and everything was gray. That's what I remember. Tara Shay Nesbitt has been writing features in Iowa Review, Quarterly West, Hayden's Ferry Review, and other literary journals. She teaches creative writing and literature courses at the University of Denver and is the nonfiction editor of Better Culture and Lit. She's a graduate of the MFA program at Washington University in St. Louis, and she's currently pursuing a PhD in creative writing and literature at the University of Denver. And we're really fortunate to call her a Colorado author, and she lives in Boulder with her family. So please welcome Tara Shay Nesbitt.
It's so great to see you all. Thank you, Lisa, for the introduction. And I didn't realize that you almost moved to Los Alamos. So you said, where did you go instead?
We stayed here.
Okay, right. better. So I'm going to read, hopefully not tire your ears out too much, probably about 15, 18 minutes. And then if there's time for Q&A, I'm happy to talk about it. And last night I read in Boulder, and there was one woman who was a child in Los Alamos, and it was great for her to share her experience. So if you have personal connection, I'd also love to hear that, and I'm sure everyone else here would love to know as well. Okay, so thanks for coming. I'm going to just start from the beginning, and I'll cut a couple paragraphs, but mostly just from the beginning. West. Over the Black Sea, the Mediterranean, the Pacific, the Arctic, the Atlantic. In sewers and trenches, on the ocean and the sky, there was a war going on. Sometimes it seemed far away, barely happening, but then a mother or a wife placed a gold star in her living room window. Her brother, her husband, her son, our neighbor, and the war became personal. It was March. Gas was rationed, therefore the streets were quiet. We heard a car pull up. We wiped our hands on our apron and placed the apron on the dishes. The doorbell rang, and a young man, just slightly older than our husbands, perhaps 35, stood on our porch in a pork pie hat and asked whether the professor was home. His eyes were the color of stillness, something between a pale body of water and the fog that emerges above it. Although dinner was almost ready, our house was chilly, we could not turn on the gas heater, and we invited him in, but felt embarrassed by the cold. Our husbands came downstairs and they shook hands. This man was tall, but his shoulders stooped, as if he had spent his life trying to appear smaller than he was in order to make others more comfortable. He asked our husbands about their research at the university. We asked him to stay for dinner. He declined, but said to our husbands, "I've got a proposal." And together they walked down the hallway to our husband's office, and the door closed behind them. Our husbands joined us in the kitchen and said, "We're going to the desert." And we had no choice except to say, "Oh my," as if that sounded like great fun. "Where?" we asked, and no one answered. If we were the ones to see the man to the door, the future director of our future unknown location, on the front porch, he said to us, "I think you'll like life up there." We said, "Where's up there exactly?" He hesitated and said, "My two loves are physics and the desert. My wife is my mistress." We watched him walk down the sidewalk two blocks and turn the corner. Or it didn't happen like that at all. One day after we read books to our children, after we folded back their blankets, kissed them, tried to hurry along their sleep, we came downstairs to find our husbands smoking a pipe in their wing-back chair, the orange one, an ugly thing we did not like. And we heard them ask us, "How'd you like to live in the Southwest?" And we plopped down on the couch, and we bounced the seat cushions, just as our children did, which annoyed us. But when we did it, we found it exceedingly enjoyable. We were European women born in Southampton, Western women born in California, East Coast women born in Connecticut, Midwestern women born in Nebraska, Southern women from Mississippi, and no matter who we were, we wanted nothing to do with starting all over again. And so we paused, exhaled, asked, "What part of the Southwest?" Our husbands muttered, "Well, I don't know." Or one winter day, our husbands came home with burns on their right arms and told us their bosses said they needed to go west to recuperate. Out west, there would be work, they said, though they could not give more specifics about where out west. We had degrees from Mount Holyoke, as our grandmothers did, or from a junior college, as our fathers insisted. We had coursework from MIT. We had doctorates from Yale and Cornell. We were certain we could discover for ourselves just where it was we would be moving. What do we know about the Southwest? A new dam, Hoover, that could perhaps power a grand experiment in the desert. To this and other conjectures, we asked our husbands to nod yes or no. "You won't be telling," we said. But no matter how seductively or how kindly we asked where and placed a hand on them, our husbands would not say, even if they did know, which we suspected they did. A few of us had experienced secrecy already. Our husbands were professors at Columbia or the University of Chicago, and just that past month, the physics lab was renamed the metallurgical lab, and no one in the lab, especially our husbands, were metallurgists or did any kind of metal extracting. The college hired armed guards to be posted inside the doors of the metallurgical lab, and in the last weeks, even the wives were no longer permitted to enter. A week before we left, a gentleman came to the door, showed us a badge, and said, "Do you mind if I ask you a few questions?" Over iced tea and stale sugar cookies, we were quizzed about our presence at a Marxist pedagogy meeting in 1940, or we were asked why we were on the list of members of the League of Women Shoppers, and didn't we know that organization was a communist front? We were only a year out of Russia, and was it true we had been captains in the Russian army? Was it true we taught English classes for the Communist Party Workers' School in Youngstown, Ohio? We told the short man with the inscrutable expressions that we wanted nothing to do with the Communist Party, that we were never involved, or that we weren't involved anymore. We said we had only been associated with them because of a previous love affair, or we did not see the point anymore, or we had become disillusioned after Pearl Harbor. We were asked to name our affiliates, and we said it was difficult to recall the people we knew then, that our memory was fuzzy on the dates and locations. We said this even if our memory was not fuzzy. Judging by his scowling face, this man did not like these answers, but he went away, and no one else came to see us, and so it seemed we were still leaving for the wilderness. Some of our husbands left first. We watched them disappear into train terminals, through the doors of unmarked black sedans, down airport runways, and we were left behind. We called our friends from the phone booth, and they met us at the train station or at our house with a loaf of bread or a chicken casserole in a flask. We wondered aloud how we would ever survive without our friends to comfort us. On our last day, we went to see Oklahoma on Broadway, or For Whom the Bell Tolls, at the Mayan Theater, and we ate at the Italian restaurant, Luciano's, that we had always wanted to try. We returned our library books. We picked up a copy of the family medical records. We took a long walk alone and asked ourselves why we had not done this sooner. We saw, for what seemed like the first time, the things we actually liked about the city we were leaving. We thought we would be joyful saying goodbye to the unfriendly pharmacist, Mr. Williams, but that was not true. We took the car to the shop to get the oil changed. We dropped off our children's old bike tires, our worn-out bathing cap, and a bucket of nails our husbands left in the garage to the Junior League's metal and rubber drive. We bought a few more war bonds. We went to the ration office and handed a sealed envelope to the woman at the counter. She read the letter inside, gave us a curious look, and provided us with enough gas rations to get our car to the other side of the country. We went to Barbara's and got a manicure. We requested a bright cherry red, even though we knew it would ship by the end of the day. We sewed curtains for rooms we had never seen, hoping the colors would look right and the dimensions would be correct. We packed the linens and not the piano, and we were secretly happy to realize our children would not be able to continue lessons where we were going. We were told there was no piano teacher, which meant we would no longer have to hear them practicing chopsticks over and over again. Or we were appalled. Our children would not have the necessary experience of piano at a young age. And though we did not think we made good teachers, we were too soft or we were too impatient. Once we arrived and unpacked our dishes, we volunteered to teach piano in the lodge, which was also the movie theater, the gymnasium, and the community mess hall. Several children would learn to play Bach after dinner. The movers came and out went our sofa, our books, and our cutlery. As they loaded boxes, our neighbors drove past, slowed down, double-backed, asked, "Where are you headed, and why didn't you tell us?" "You've been great neighbors. You'll be sorely missed." We said vacation or a change of scenery or Jim's work. Our neighbors did not believe us, though they smiled as if they did. We boarded trains in Philadelphia or in Chicago, with GIs all looking identical in their dog tags, their black-rimmed glasses, their Gosling short hair. Perhaps it was unpatriotic, but we were annoyed at the GIs who ate before us and delayed our dinners until 10 o'clock, and who therefore made our children less manageable. Though we were only 25, we were tired, and we were with our children, who reminded us what we were tethered to. Children who were bored for hours and who pinched and kicked one another. When our children whined, "He hit me, she started it," after 8 hours on the train, which probably felt like years, we ran out of ways to keep them occupied. And instead, we finally just stared out the window as if we were noticing the beige nuances of tan landscapes, which we were not. By the time we arrived, we had seen so many mountains, they had lost any sense of the majestic. Or less frequently, our husbands went with us. They drove us in red Studebakers, in green Oldsmobiles, our back seats filled with clothes, books, children, and the family cat, Roscoe, who meowed for hours. We stopped along the way to visit our parents, who asked repeatedly where we were going and for whom we could not tell. Our fathers hit their fist on the table and said, "You think we're Nazi spies? Tell us." Our mothers said, "Be careful," or "Write me as soon as you can." Later, when our fathers cooled off, when they said, touching our arm, "I'm your father, you can tell me anything," we did not tell them where we were going because we still did not know. We hugged our mothers, pecked our fathers on the cheek, glanced out the window to see our husbands checking the air pressure in the tires. Our mothers understood. Our mothers had kept great secrets. We loaded up the children, the cat, and the snacks, and headed west. Us. We were round-faced, athletic, boisterous, austere, thin-boned, cat-like, and awkward. When we challenged people's political views, we were described as stubborn or outspoken. Our fathers were academics. We knew the academic world. We married men just like our fathers, or nothing like them, or only the best parts. As the wives of scientists in college towns, we gave tea parties and gossiped, or we lived in the city and hosted cocktail hours. We served cigarettes on tin trays. We leaned in close to the other wives, pretending we were good friends, cupping our hands and whispering into their ears. And, most importantly, we found out how to get our husband's tenure. Not all of us were born in America, and not all of us knew the academic world. Some of our parents had immigrated while our own mothers were in their third trimester, and some of us had immigrated when we were newly married and not yet pregnant ourselves. We left Paris when we heard the Germans were taking over the city, or we left Italy when we woke one cold January morning to hear a Nazi anthem being sung in an upbeat tenor outside our bedroom window. We asked what is happening to the world. We packed two suitcases, told the men at the checkpoint we were leaving on holiday, and went to America instead. Some of us remembered World War I from the vantage point of elementary school age worries, going without salt, butter, and cookies, and now as young adults, we did not want to get involved. Or we thought about that December morning in 1941 when the Japanese, depending on who told the story, were angered by trade embargoes that restricted their purchase of oils and metals, or wanted to possess all of the islands in the Pacific Ocean. We went to Spanish relief parties the night before Pearl Harbor with our husbands, and the next day when the war broke out, we both decided that there were more pressing crises than the Spanish cause. That was 3 years ago, and we had followed so much news it was hard to keep up, but we knew this. Germany's Hitler and Italy's Mussolini were taking over Europe. Japan's Tojo was dominating the Pacific. And in Europe, the news of German occupations gave many of us the desire to do something. The Axis and the Allies, would it never end? We arrived in New Mexico and thought we had come to the end of the earth, or we thought we had come home. It was 94 degrees and the sun was merciless. We traveled up, up, up along switchbacks, passing the flat tops of the mesas, and as seen from high enough, their finger-like cliffs. Down below, the Rio Grande picked up soil on the banks and made a deep red river for as far as we could see. We saw the pink flowering chola, the red-orange flowers of the claret cup cactus, the yellow blossoms of the prickly pear. We drove through the guts of mountains, brown, yellow, pink, and gray strata stretching sky high, cut away to make this road, and cut away by centuries of water and wind. We stepped off trains 9 months pregnant, or carrying six-week-olds in closed baskets, or holding the hands of our two-year-olds, our Bobbies, and our Margarets. Our Marshes got chickenpox along the way and were quarantined to the back of the train. We arrived at 7,200 feet above sea level, dizzy, sweaty, and nauseous. We arrived short of breath, in high heels, green silk blouses that tied at the collar, and blue skirts, our best outfits, damp, wrinkled, and clinging to our backs. We arrived in need of a shampoo, in gloves and hats, as if we had never left the city, as if the sand and dirt and dust were not in our hair and our teeth, as if we were not resentful that we did not have a choice. We got off at Lammy, looked around, and saw no one except a handsome woman in blue jeans. She was tall, so tall, slender, and had a police dog at her side. This was New Mexico. Or we were told to transfer from the train to Lammy to a bus, and once we got off in Santa Fe, someone would be there looking for us, but no one was there waiting, and we arrived teary and red-eyed and peered into the glass case of pecan pies at the diner in Santa Fe, the only thing open at 5 a.m., 11 p.m., until a waitress in a starched cotton dress looked us up and down and said, "Ma'am, you're looking for 109 East Palace, around the corner." Or we arrived looking for the office and entered a bakery, and we thought there must be a trick, that we could just order a loaf of bread for access to the secret location. But we stumbled on our order because we were not given instructions on what exactly to ask for. So we said things in a tone punctuated with question marks, often requesting items that were not on the menu. Pain au chocolat? Bagel? The bored baker interrupted, "You must be looking for the office down the way. Take a left." We thanked him, and we took a left. We went around the corner, followed the sidewalk, and passed adobe houses, houses built with the soil surrounding them, the curved corners of walls smoothed by numerous hands, and houses hanging with tricolored corn and chilies. Our children asked, "Where are we?" Nailed to a white door was a metal sign, 109. Our children ran toward it, opening the door, which banged loudly behind us. A woman in pearls and a pink or blue tweed suit with an upturned nose held two black telephone receivers to both ears and said, inaudibly, just mouths, "I'll be right with you." A small white dog rested at our feet and opened one eye to look at us. The woman had friendly, bulbous cheeks, and when she put the receivers back on the cradles, she went over the specific rules of our new home. We thought she must have encountered several like us before. Tired, weary, expectant, nervous. Which was true. She had. Dorothy took our pictures, our fingerprints, and informed us we would be getting a new name. Some of us had been told this would happen. Others were shocked, and a few were simply resigned. Though many of our husbands were celebrities among academic circles, the point here in our new home was not to draw attention. And so, despite our thick Italian or Danish accents that would give away our heritage as soon as we spoke, we became something more all-American. Mrs. Fermi became Mrs. Farmer, and Mrs. Mueller was now Mrs. Miller. We knew that we were becoming part of an entity larger than our families, larger than ourselves, and we were not necessarily happy about it. Our husbands were not around to hear our complaints, or if they were around, we felt we could not bother them with our petty grievances. Our son, Bill, who was almost 10, who was looking forward to the desert, announced when the tips of our fingers were dark with ink, "We're important." This was the first, though not last time, our sons exclaimed this. "Come by if you need anything," Dorothy said. She gave us a yellow map that marked every mile from where we were to go, from where we were to where we would be going, with red pencil, all the way to our final destination called the Hill, which was 35 more miles, all up. We would not have a phone. We did not have a car. How could we possibly come by if we needed anything? Our husband's friends met us with a borrowed army car and drove us the 35 miles uphill. Or we got on an army bus parked outside 109 East Palace, a large machine that released thick gray clouds of exhaust. A man tipped his hat and loaded the bus with our mops, brooms, and potted plants. We looked around to see several other tense faces, but none that were familiar. We smiled and took off our gloves. We wondered which of them would become our friends, or we decided immediately whom we thought we would like to be friends with. And if we were with our husbands, at Atawi, we took a one-lane suspension bridge that was so rickety only small cars could use it. Our bodies swayed as we rounded sharp corners, and our husbands sang, "People will say we're in love." And for a moment, this unknown future could be almost, could be an adventure, could be almost romantic. We turned on the radio because we were too curious not to, and thankfully, instead of bad news, we heard that the U.S. and British forces had landed in Sicily. We felt light with hope. High up on a mountain, we saw a spiral of spinning dust. Miles later, we were the ones driving. We took a bend too quickly. Our children yelled, "Stop!" And as the car slowed, they flung the doors open and vomited in the middle of the gravel road. We arrived newlyweds, or with a seven-year itch, or still great friends, or no longer in love but trying to keep it together for our children or for ourselves. Some of us always expected disaster and kept the shades drawn low. Some of us were quickly skeptical, although no one could tell, and we were nicknamed Polly. Some of us always made do, and we quickly established knitting circles and book clubs. Some of us thrived on gatherings, and we created dance nights and afternoon teas and bridge clubs. Though the dance parties of the night before still lingered, we were Catholic, and we had Sunday service in Fuller Lodge at 8 a.m., or we were Protestant, and we had service at 10 a.m. As we walked into the lodge, we smelled dank, cheap beer, and the spilled drinks made our shoes catch on the sticky wood floor. Like many moving toward an unknown future, we clung to the beliefs that had carried us this far, about people, the world, our husbands, the war, until that strategy could no longer assuage our fears. Thanks. So I would be happy to answer questions, and if you have a Los Alamos connection, I'd love to hear that as well. Yes. Yeah. I love that question because the answer feels very roundabout. It's I had a friend in friend who told me about a high school in Eastern Washington whose mascot is a mushroom cloud. They're the home of the atomic bombers. Does anybody know this? Some of you might know because you're my friends and I've told you this story. But no, so it's Richland, Washington is the town, and it's the secret Manhattan Project of Hanford where they were doing the uranium production. So it's similar to Oak Ridge, Tennessee, but I didn't know any of that. And I was living in Washington, and so I just went and took a nuclear tour of the site, which is actually still in use predominantly to now they're a nuclear waste repository, and they're doing some cleanup and all this stuff. But I just wanted to know about the nuclear legacy. That was the initial idea. And I started going back further and further. I thought, if these people are working on uranium enrichment and they don't know what they're building, who are the people that made them do that? And in one way, you could say, oh, the military. But no, not really. I mean, who did this development? And I started looking at the scientists, and then from there, I thought about who made this town. And I think the women were part of this, like, a huge part of making this town and making the bomb, even if they weren't doing the science of that. And I wanted to bring forth their voices. So,
was there nothing there before 1941?
Oh, yeah. No, there were. Okay, that's also a great story. Can I just take you with me everywhere and you can ask me questions? I want to talk about this. I didn't mention this in the reading, but there's this social strata that if you were living in Los Alamos, what differentiated you is if you had a bathtub or if you didn't have a bathtub. And those homes were the original stone homes that were first built because an investor, I think he was a Michigan investor, thought that this would be a great place for people to come and relax. And I think if you had, you know, lung problems, maybe the air would be good for you. But it failed. So what they did instead was turn it into the Los Alamos Ranch School, which is a boys' school. And they got a lot of East Coast elite families to send their boys there. In fact, William Burroughs was one person that was there, and Gore Vidal was there as well. So it became that. And then Oppenheimer had visited there. What was that? Oh, Oppenheimer. So Oppenheimer and Groves, the military person who had developed the Pentagon, or he had already had a lot of power and in development. The two of them got together and were trying to find a location, and Los Alamos was perfect, and Oppenheimer knew it because he had spent some time there as a kid. But it's, you know, it's a mesa. Well, it's a potrero, but it's a mesa, and so it's separated from anything, and so it's easily guarded. So that's how they found it. Yeah. Oh, great. Welcome.
So I'm curious if you've visited there.
I have. People ask me that question, and I have many times, but there's always that sense of, like, what if I hadn't? They would not like me very much. Yes, I have. I worked with the Los Alamos Historical Society, and the archivist there at the city of Los Alamos, which is a great, I don't know if you've gone, I'm sure you've gone to the lodge and looked around. And you were. Well, right at the once the bombs were dropped, what was amazing is the next day there was an article in the Santa Fe, New Mexican, I think, that said, "Now the stories can be told." Stories was misspelled, two O's. And somehow they had all this information, and a lot of the wives recollect. So I did a lot of research by reading listening to oral histories and reading memoirs and things like that. And the wives will recollect, like, how did they were telling us how many people were here, and we didn't even know, you know? So how did they have access to all this information? But that also, I think that they probably felt really exposed, immediately exposed. People could, you know, come in and ask them questions about what was life like, you know? Joanna, I think your hand was up. Yeah. That's a great question, and I wish I had an easy answer, because I know Joanna's a writer too, so she probably, you know, has this challenge. But I originally listened to, like, read a lot of things, so I was getting, like, lots of women's voices sort of all at once, and they were all mashed up in my mind. There were so many of them, because I would just go through and read all day and then try to write. But somehow I got a rhythm of a voice, and I think it was when I was taking a class with Laird Hunt, and we were reading Aelis at the Fire by John Foss, and it's a story, it's a really short novel, and it's a story of, in my memory, a woman who is just in her house recollecting all these moments in time, kind of cohabitating, in which, like, her husband's alive, but he's actually dead, and she's there, but she's not there. And somehow that, like, polyphony of voice or something like that, like this mini-voiced, came to me at the same time that I was thinking of the mini-voice of the wives. And I did a lot of research, and I originally thought it could be nonfiction, and I thought that the first person plural would do that, because I can say, or it was like this for us, or it was like this. And I thought I was very ingenious about that. I'm like, oh, it's all nonfiction. This is great. And then I guess I realized at some point that There was a certain emotionality that I couldn't get to because the women aren't alive anymore. So I couldn't ask follow-up questions. And I wanted to get a little closer to them in some ways. And also, I think people have a hard time telling their secrets. And I knew that there were things there. But so I'm still a little tentative about what those secrets are and how I manage them. For instance, there's a game called Musical Beds. And that's referenced by several women, but nobody really is talking about what that means. I'm sure it's like Scrabble, but so I sort of had to go with it, you know? So, okay, I'll sort of imagine here what this might be. So I don't know if that answers your question. The other thing is that when I was listening to the oral histories, the women would often go into we. They would say, like, this, it's like this for us. We had the stove problem. We had this water shortage. Can you believe what the military is doing to us? So it felt really natural to inhabit their voices and the way that they were seeing themselves. And then I wanted to, like, put that in contrast to the individual, which particularly I think comes out later when the bombs are used. And there's some more differentiation about how they react to that. That's this shared life thing that they're building, but they don't know what they're building, and then how do they react? Yeah. Hi, Matt. Good to see you. Yeah. Matt, tell me if I'm getting this wrong, but he was saying that he wasn't for sure, but he had heard about the people that had actually dropped the bombs, so the pilots and the people that were on the plane, that they suffered greatly afterwards, and suffering being kind of broadly defined, mentally or physically. And he was asking that there could be remorse. So if I saw some of that in the women, was that about right, Matt? The person that I think of about the use of the bombs is, maybe it was Tibbetts. There's one person that had a lot of, seemed to have a lot of guilt and actually went, like, tried to apologize, tried to, like, can I come back on the anniversary and formally apologize to your city? And they said, no, you know, you don't need to do that. And he's done a lot of art. If you look at Boing Boing, Boing Boing has covered him for making these art sculptures that are like him trying to work out his feelings about it. That's only one person. I can't speak to the others. But from the women, I saw like a range of things, like a delightful, yeah, wasn't it crazy the time we did this? We'd ride the horses down and we'd get really drunk on whiskey and we'd gossip and can you believe this? And so they would just spend some time thinking about it, like what life was like in our 20s, general reminiscing that we might do now. One woman that I really felt connected to because she wrote a memoir, and so I had 300 pages to be with her, was Phyllis Fisher. And she grew up in San Francisco, and she became a social worker. And she wrote her book, and she addresses it to the Little Lady of Hiroshima. And she says, Little Lady of Hiroshima, I want to tell you I grieve with you. I want to say I'm sorry. And so she really took on a particular sense of responsibility that I didn't actually, that was the anomaly in what I heard. But what's difficult about that is, like, these are collections put together by the Historical Society. People probably feel like, do you want to tell your happy stories? And so I'm curious about the kinds of stories that we tell when we're recollecting to strangers and the kinds of stories that we probably don't tell and the ones that become more private. And Phyllis Fisher's book is on a Japanese publication, a Japanese press. So it's not even an American press. And that's a curious thing to me, too. So thank you. That's a great question. Yeah, Joan. Yeah. Yeah, so the question of did any of the women seem to know what their husbands were building? I will say that if they did, they never tell you know, they were never recollecting that they did. But there was one woman, Eleanor, and I've been saying Eleanor Jett, but I actually think it's Jetty because I met a woman last night who knew her and said Jetty. So Eleanor Jetty, she has a little memoir, and she says that she knew quite early on. She's the inspiration for the figure who grew up in Denver and then decides, like, okay, my husband's got to have a lot of power. It's probably the Hoover Dam. It's got to be an experiment. I'm guessing it's a bomb. You know, she would say this to her husband, and he would be like, you're completely wrong, and don't tell anybody about this. So, you know, and she was a big social gatherer. She loved riding horses, and she loved having cocktail hours, and she would seem to bring in a lot of people. She was like one of the founding members of the town council. And so I do wonder how much she was talking to her friends about it. There is, when the bomb is tested, at least one husband, as he's leaving, so you see all these people leaving for the weekend, all the husbands are leaving, and one wife recollects, like, everybody important is leaving except us. What's going on? And one of the husbands says, well, if you look out towards this direction, maybe you might see something. And so some of the wives were like, let's, you know, stay up all night and figure out what we can see. And so, and it would be really, really far away. I mean, I think you could just see like a flare in the distance. You're nodding no, you don't think that's true. It's very far away. So I don't know how that recollection comes about, but these are and another thing to think about is how the tales get retold in your memory. So I'm going off of the tales that they've retold in their memories. So I do wonder. I wonder how much they knew. But most of them seem to have not known, especially Phyllis, who I think really had a lot of... Her husband, she was pregnant at the time, and her husband took them camping in the other direction many, many miles away. And so I don't think she knew. Yeah. Yeah, at this particular, at Los Alamos, the scientists all knew. And that was the military didn't want them to have shared information, because at the other sites, everyone was really kept quite separate. But the scientists were like, we have to talk. I mean, how are we going to build a bomb if we can't talk to one another about what we're doing? So they all knew. But at the, you reminded me of something. When it looked like the bomb was going to work, some of the scientists got together and got a petition to say, let's make sure that we don't actually use this. We just show other people that we have it and that we can use it. And that petition was not passed. And some of the recollections say Oppenheimer said something like, let's leave the politics to the politician and the scientists to the scientists. And they go back to the lab. So there was a lot. And then later, whole other story of how the scientists reacted. But I think that they had mixed feelings, too. Even while they were building. Any other? I think we're probably...
One more question? Well, okay. Well, I don't think I've read a novel in that first person plural before. So, I mean, are you the only one doing it, or what?
No. No, I'm not.
Do you sustain it through the whole book?
I do. I try. It is. It's in some ways a short novel, so I think that sustaining that voice gets difficult as the novel, if one creates a really long novel. But no, first person plural novels seem to be happening a lot right now. Justin Torres has a book called We the Animals. There is Joshua Ferris's book, Then We Came to an End. So there's one about siblings growing up together, We the Animals, and then We Came to the End is like a failing advertising firm in Chicago. I think roughly that's what it's about. But then there are books you can go farther back, like Zim Yatton's book, We, which is what became the inspiration for like 1984 and Brave New World. So that's Russia in the 1920s. And then, of course, you can look at Flaubert's, or you could look at Madame Bovary. The beginning of that is in the We. And I think I used to say things like really grand things like, oh, I think this is happening because people are trying to navigate what our responsibility is as a group member, as a we, and then as an individual. But I'm not, and I do think that's true, but I think that that's been true since there have been people. So I don't know why it's happening now, but I think maybe people are more accustomed to the voice, and so we can do it, and it doesn't seem quite as alienating as it has in the past. But thanks for asking. Okay. So thank you so much for coming.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.